You're listening to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. But we're back after a short hiatus, I'm pleased to say, and there's lots to catch up on, including how the polls have changed in ways that you might not realise in the last couple of months, and what might be behind that. We'll be talking about Russia, Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, and the recent anti-Semitism crisis that appears to have engulfed the Labour Party. I'm joined as ever by my podcaster in crime, Leo Barassi. Leo, welcome back to Polling Matters.
Hello, Kieran.
It's been a while, hasn't it?
It's been a few weeks.
So let's talk about the polls and how they've moved, because in preparation for this podcast, I must admit, I hadn't quite realised just how much the polls had shifted in the last sort of couple of months or so. It does seem like, doesn't it, that the Tories have taken something of a lead.
Yeah, it's quite new to be able to say exactly how you put it. I think what's been going on for a while, and I think we can by a while say a few months, has been a slight drifting together of the parties, really slow and not always perceptible. But what's happened essentially this month has been that for the first time, the Tories have consistently got a lead. So in polls in four of the last five agencies to have reported, the Tories have been ahead, and that lead's been small, between 1 and 3 points. But that's the first time that's happened since before the election. So whether or not that might change when a few more come out, I'm not sure. But it definitely is the case that the polls have got a lot closer than they were a few months ago. And it feels like it's been a constant movement rather than a sort of one-off.
And I guess what really struck me looking at this was that I guess it does show maybe how the media are not that interested in headline voting intention figures, certainly at the moment. And maybe part of that is because there isn't a general election for a long time, or so we think. But part of that is obviously the difficulties that polls have had. And I guess we can come to that in a minute. But to give the listeners some idea of what we're talking about, so the most recent ICM poll fieldwork was the 16th to the 18th of March, so mid-month. And the Tories were on 44, Labour 41. Opinium had a poll around the same time, Tories 42, Labour 40. YouGov have had a bunch of different polls. The latest I can find has the Tories on 42, Labour 39, although I should be said that's something of an outlier for YouGov. The previous YouGov poll did have Labour ahead. And Servation, back a little bit earlier in March, had Labour some 7 points ahead, 44 to 37. Now, of course, Servation being the outlier there, but as we well know from the general election, nothing wrong with being an outlier if you're Servation. They were an outlier at the general election, and they were the ones that were proven correct. So, and there are some issues there around when fieldwork was conducted. So perhaps if Servation did one this weekend, things would look very different. So that gives us some numbers to play with. I mean, what's your take on it, Leo? I mean, do you think that the media are just ignoring headline voting intention figures at the moment?
So there's a couple of things to pick up on there. I mean, the first is, I think you could potentially make an argument that Labour support has drifted down very slightly. I think you kind of have to squint a bit to get that. But what's certainly the case is that support for the Tories has gone up a little. So compared with the numbers in the sort of high 30s that they were getting a few months ago, they're now very clearly in the low 40s, at least in the most recent polls. So that seems to be what's going on behind it. I mean, look, I think, you know, it's not a surprise that the media are generally not that excited about talking about polling. I think we're at a point where, particularly far from an election, they understandably feel like they would probably be laughed at a bit if they focused on small shifts and small leads like this. But I think, I mean, it is interesting, and historically it is important. If you look back on sort of the last few decades, really since the 80s, every time there's been a change of government in the polling, very soon after the previous election, the polls have shifted pretty definitively towards the opposition. So we're talking about after 92, after 2005, and not at other times. Essentially, the polls moved very soon after those elections. The fact it's not happening now, look, the last election obviously did show that things can change quite dramatically, but on a historical precedent, it's not great news for Labour that we're this many months after the election and the polls are not only failing to turn in their favour, but if anything, they're turning a bit towards the Tories.
I think there's one lesson I took from the general election. It's that we've got to be a bit cautious about the rules, as it were, because, I mean, one of the rules was that the campaign didn't really matter. However you went into a general election campaign, by and large, would be where you ended up. Or at least you couldn't change things as significantly as Labour ended up doing. Let's at least say that. And that turned out not to be true. But to counter that slightly, one thing that all pollsters did pick up at the general election was the shift to Labour. It's just that they disagreed on where the starting point was and how big that shift was, maybe, let's say. So I think what we can be reasonably confident of is there has been a shift towards the Tories in the last sort of month or so. What we can't say is whether, if there was a general election tomorrow, what that would mean. So necessarily that means, because the Tories are 2 or 3 points ahead, that means that they would win a general election. And that's before we even get into the fact that a 2 or 3 point Tory lead doesn't necessarily mean they would win, does it?
Right. I mean, the point is, there isn't going to be an election tomorrow. And that's significant when you look at the polls, because it's not just the lead and the relative position of the parties we should pay attention to, but it's also the fact that both of them are still polling at a historically high level. So combining the two puts them on a total score of pretty comfortably above 80%. Now, other than the election that we've just had, there hasn't been an election in which those two parties got more than 80% since 83. So this still feels like pretty unusual territory. And that raises the possibility that, well, first, there's not much space for them to go up. There aren't that many more votes that they can win compared with where the parties normally are. And there's quite a lot of space for them to go down. They've quite a lot of voters potentially to lose should other parties, other arguments start appealing more. Now, the way the landscape looks at the moment is not obvious where that comes from, but it certainly you can see how the position that we're in at the moment isn't stable if there are other forces that come into play.
Let's talk about what might be behind some of these numbers, or at least the political weather that we face. We've not been doing the podcast for a few weeks. That's my fault. So what stories have you noticed that you think are quite important at the moment?
Well, I think the one that we've got to get straight to, because it seems the most strikingly relevant and I think it's pretty clear that it's captured public attention the most, is the Russia nerve agent Salisbury attack. And there's a couple of bits of evidence about that. The first is there's this regular tracker that Populous do, asking about which news stories have been mentioned. And often what that finds is the stories that we want to talk about on the podcast haven't really been picked up. That's not the case with this. The Russia spy poisoning, even last week, so a good couple of weeks after it happened, was still easily the most mentioned. 42% of people picked it as the news story that first came to mind. So that's quite striking, that this is something that is clearly in the news. And similarly, just to back up that Populous data, there was a YouGov poll from a bit closer to the time that asked, among other things, and I think we will talk about what those other things were, how close are you following the story? And again, 58% said that they're following it closely. Only 18% said that they are not following it, and 4% said they're not aware of it. So more than 3/4 of people were in some way aware of the story. So for a political story, it feels like one that is unusually dominant in the news. And I think it is arguably a factor behind why the polls have shifted in the last couple of weeks.
One of the things I'm interested in is going to be following the next batch of voting intention polls that comes out in the not too distant future, because I have a suspicion that the chronology of this, I think the Russia story was roughly breaking around the time some of the polls we've cited, mid-March, early March. I'm not sure it's fully digested by that point. And then, of course, we've had all the other stuff which we'll come to around anti-Semitism, and we haven't forgotten about that, folks. We will get to that at some point on this podcast. But it's a strange feeling, isn't it, Leah? We're normally the first to be playing down you know, well, this is a Westminster bubble story, that sort of thing. But clearly it's not, is it?
We're often ones who play down the idea that polls have moved because of an external event, and that is usually overblown. And I would be a bit cautious about saying that with certainty, but I think there's a possibility to that, of that.
What do you think it is that actually makes this capture the imagination versus other stories?
Yeah, I mean, the basic structure of the story is arguably a foreign state has launched an attack on British soil. That's inherently an important major news story, and one that quite understandably quite recently captures the news. And the way that the international response has continued to develop has given the story legs in a way that, if not much more had happened, say a bit more like the Litvinenko affair, as I recall, at least there weren't the kind of immediate international developments that meant that there was lots of new stuff happening in the story in the way that there has been with this. But I think, as well as that question of why it's captured people's attention, there's, I think, an interesting question about why we think it might have had some political impact in voting intent, because I don't think just the fact that it was important and catch people's attention would necessarily translate to it having a sort of party political effect. One of the striking things in that YouGov poll was there was a really sharp difference between how well people think the two leaders are handling it. So May has 53% saying she handled it well, and only 23% badly. So that's plus 30. Corbyn has 18% well and 39% badly, so minus 21 points. So a big difference between the two.
Yeah, and I think that going back to your point you were making a moment ago about this story having legs, as it were, we should bear in mind that the outlook for the two victims isn't very good. And as far as I'm aware, they're still alive. So, I mean, if they do pass away, I don't know how long that would take. Well, regardless of what happens, frankly, there's going to be a moment where they either get out of hospital and they're alive or they don't. And that means that it's not a story we're going to forget about, is it? For either reason, either hopefully they survive, obviously, and then they have their tell-all or maybe not. And you know, but anyway, there's some sort of story around that, them getting out of hospital, where do they go and all this. And of course, if they die, then that's a whole other thing, isn't it? I was just going to say, but going back to the polling you mentioned, so it looks like Theresa May seems to have been seen to do well. Does that mean that there's no argument for Corbyn's we need the evidence line, do you think? Is there anything in the polling that suggests that might be the case?
Well, it's really interesting because Corbyn, I would say, has generally proved to be quite adept at reading and channeling the public mood on international affairs. I think in the post-Iraq age, his instincts are pretty closely aligned with the public in terms of scepticism about use of force, but in fact, arguably more widely than that, scepticism about being involved in any sort of diplomatically forceful international activity. So his position of caution, when I first heard it, I thought that it was going to be quite popular, and his view was essentially where the public was. Now, to an extent, that is borne out. The same poll asked people whether they think the Russian state was responsible. Now, only 32% said that they think the Russian state was almost certainly responsible. So really, only one in three agree with the government's position. Now, 41% say it was probably responsible, and the rest are...
I was going to say that I think we're reading those numbers slightly differently between you and I. I mean, yeah, you're right to say. So this is a 4-point scale question. The Russian state was certainly responsible. The Russian state was probably responsible. And the wording's a bit longer than that, but you know, top two box kind of thing. 73% say certainly versus or probably, and as you say, 32% say certainly. I mean, for me, I read that as almost three quarters essentially blame the Russian government.
Yeah, but I think what you've got there is essentially the difference between Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn's position. So Theresa May's position was essentially the Russian state did it, we should take action now. Corbyn's position, as I understood it, was essentially they probably did it, but we need more evidence. Now, what I think his problem is that he hasn't successfully communicated that position. One of the striking things about his how well or badly did he handle it question is that the one that won was don't know. Labour voters were more likely to say they don't know if he handled it well than to say that he did handle it well. And it feels to me like there probably was a space for him at least a week or so ago of very clearly saying a kind of, I'm horrified by this. This is appalling. We don't know for sure. We think it was probably Russia, but we shouldn't take any action until we're certain, but we should take this measure, gather an international thing, alliance, and when doing that, have these proper processes to essentially make this a fair trial. Now, I think he failed to articulate that because his message was very confused. It got shouted down and he wasn't able to get to that place. I think that moment's passed. Mm. And unless he gets on board the quite forceful response, then it's hard to see this turning in his favour, at least in the next couple of weeks.
I think going back to your original point about how he's usually been finger on the pulse in terms of these issues, I just think he's underestimated the fact that Russia is not Iraq, meaning that, you know, when it comes to issues of terrorism and the role of British foreign policy in, I don't know if provoking is the right word, but in kind of bringing some of that on ourselves and it's partly our fault, all that sort of thing. I think there is a degree of sympathy, as you say, for that argument. Not sympathy for the terrorists, of course, but just the argument that, if we weren't involved in these foreign adventures, then this wouldn't be as much of a problem. We've shown on this podcast, though, if you do favourability ratings of different countries, of different world leaders, Russia and Putin typically are around the bottom. I'm not convinced. Well, no, I'll reverse that statement. I am convinced that British public opinion is pretty anti-Putin and pretty anti-Russia. And therefore, I think that if we're talking about the benefit of the doubt on this issue, I don't think British public opinion is likely to give Russia that benefit of the doubt. Now, other people that listen to this might say, well, that's they're just wrong. That's regardless, they're just wrong. But in terms of public opinion, it doesn't surprise me that people are siding with Theresa May over Corbyn on this, because I think that Vladimir Putin is not the same as Libya, Iraq, Syria, etc.
That's a really interesting point. And I think the argument about the countries being seen differently is a good point, well made. I suppose potentially one misjudgment that you could understand why Corbyn and his advisors might have made is that, in contrast to the point about essentially terrorism in Britain being to some extent the result of British action abroad, which I think is a view that is reasonably widely held and Corbyn taps into, you could imagine that he does believe that Russia is somewhat unfairly treated by NATO and that they do have some point to make. As I understand it, that's a view that is quite widely held among some circles and probably some of the activist groups that Corbyn was involved in before he became leader. You can see how he might have misjudged that, as with the terrorism point, that was something that was perceived quite widely by the public in a way that wasn't true, because this just hasn't had that argument hasn't had the exposure that the terrorism argument has.
Yeah, I think that I'd also add that, I mean, maybe not on the NATO point, I wouldn't go that far, but I do think that the British media, as it were, do misunderstand Russia in lots of ways on lots of issues. I mean, if you go back to the Second World War, one of the points Corbyn made and is not the first to make is that, you know, the Russian deaths in the Second World War, for example, far, far surpassed anybody else's. I think they may have even been more than all others put together, although don't quote me on that. It was certainly huge. And I think that we often overlook Russia's sort of psychology on foreign policy and some of the justifiable reasons why they might hold their views. But I mean, just to go back to my original point, I think the second point I would add to that as to why I think that public opinion would be on Theresa May's side is my hunch is that no one sees the prospect of actual war with Russia as remotely credible. I don't think anyone thinks we're going to like bomb Russia or try and have some sort of military action against Russia. That's I mean, even saying that out loud, it sounds ludicrous to me saying it on this podcast. So, I mean, we're talking about expelling some diplomats, which has been done. I don't think this means that we're going to suddenly get involved in Ukraine or anything like that. So I don't know. I just think that where Corbyn understandably has support on things like, well, let's not get involved in Syria, you know, is this going to make things worse, that sort of thing. And we'll continue to have, I imagine, let's say if John Bolton has his way and Donald Trump ends up confronting Iran, I suspect that there'll be lots of sympathy for Corbyn's position on not bombing Iran. I'm talking ahead of myself a little bit, but if it came down to that sort of conflict later, not hard to see how it might happen. But with Russia, I think the idea of a hot war feels very unlikely, and therefore this idea of let's not rush to war, I don't think it has the same weight as it might do if it was Iran, for example.
Yeah, and his exact words were the drift to conflict, and I think that's,
yeah, I mean, what conflict,
spot on.
You know?
Yeah.
Let's move on. There's been some other stories obviously going around. One of the ones I want to talk about is this sort of Facebook sort of scandal. I think most, and Cambridge Analytica, I think most people will know the details already, but just to sort of, I guess, give a whistle-stop tour of what's going on. So there's this whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, who's come out, who used to work for Cambridge Analytica, and he's essentially alleged that Cambridge Analytica via Facebook was harvesting lots of data in sort of improper ways through a personality quiz app that basically, which people went on, they gave lots of information about what they did online. I think it's called This Is Your Digital Life. But the kicker here is that in doing that survey, in giving permission to that app to have your information, not only your information, but the information of your friends and your wider network was passed on to Facebook, and then to this app, and then to Cambridge Analytica, and then was used for commercial purposes in sort of political campaigns. I'm sure I've butchered that to some extent, but ultimately this story is about how our data is used, and specifically what Cambridge Analytica do. They've been caught on tape, on video, with Channel 4 boasting about how they can influence elections. Some of the things they were coming up with didn't have a lot to do with data, I should say. And this has raised all sorts of questions about Donald Trump's election victory in America and about the Brexit sort of vote as well. And of wider questions, which may live longer than either of those two things, about the digital age and how we use data and how our data is shared. So there's lots to unpick here. We're not going to unpick it all at once. Let's go through this kind of systematically. But on the data points, how people's data is shared, Leo, I mean, is it surprising that people don't really know or don't seem to know how their data is used? I mean, that for me doesn't feel like news as such, not that it's not important.
No, I think for better or worse, people are, as far as I can tell, just not that bothered about the use of their personal data. And I guess when there have been problems with it, when it has turned into a political story, have been things like when government departments or parts of the health service have lost personal data. I think it's been more salient because, firstly, there's something about it being the government doing it that feels somehow more outrageous. And then secondly, when it's easy to see how that could be abused in a way that directly harms individuals. So an abusive ex-partner being able to track them down, or a boss finding out information about a person that the person didn't want them to have. You could see that. But I guess when it's an opt-in service that people have chosen to use, when it's data that they've chosen to put in themselves, and where it's not obvious to an individual how they individually, as opposed to through society, have been harmed, then I guess it's not obvious where the moral outrage comes from that's needed to get people really caring about it.
Well, I broadly agree with that, although I think there are a couple of points to challenge a little bit. One would be, okay, so my understanding of this, and I'm not an expert on the technicalities, I'm trying to get somebody on in the next couple of weeks actually who is, is that, so the accusation here is that by doing, let's say I did the quiz that this academic has designed, The accusation here, I think, is that not only am I giving him my information, which is up to me, I kind of have a view that if I'm stupid enough not to know what I'm passing on, then that's my fault. But also that they could get me and you are Facebook friends. You know, they could get your information, or my wife's information, or my mum's information, or some or forms of it via me being on this app. And I don't quite. Maybe I've got that wrong. People do tweet me if I have. And that's how they were able to scale up this data collection, because it wasn't that they did, you know, 30 million of these surveys. They did maybe 250,000, let's say. I might have the figures wrong. And then they were able to get those people's networks data. And I mean, that feels, I'm not sure if that's implicitly understood, or if that implicit bargain is there in the way that the implicit bargain of I'll use Facebook for free and you can advertise to me, I think most people would accept that that's acceptable. And I think the second point I would say is that there is maybe, I'd like to see some polling on this. Maybe we'll do that with our opinion series actually this week. I reckon that there's an implicit bargain again that says, well, thinking of me personally, so I like Tottenham Hotspur on Facebook. I expect them to advertise to me. I expect maybe a beer company might advertise to me, or like a clothing company or something like that. But I'm maybe less comfortable with my information being passed on to political campaigns. Or I mean, do you think there could be a hierarchy of like where people are and are not happy for their data to be shared with, like organisations that they'd be happy for their data to be shared with?
Yeah, I guess the thing is, I agree with everything that you said. I mean, there's nothing I don't believe in the idea that people think that it's unfair that their data can be shared without their knowledge, and there are different kinds of sharing that are better and worse. I guess just I keep on coming back to the point that I don't see what the personalized story is of how this harms an individual that will get people morally outraged by it. Now, don't get me wrong, I see that there's a systematic society-wide issue going on here, but that's different from seeing why what it is that's supposed to trigger individuals feeling like this is like an offence against decency. And I just sort of feel like without that, this is going to carry on being a story that struggles to sort of get too far. Okay, a good comparison is the phone hacking story. Mm. It'd been known about for a long time, but it wasn't until it was a murdered schoolgirl that suddenly it became something that people cared about. And even then, you still needed the thing about voicemails being deleted and the parents being harmed by that for it to really like absolutely hit people's feeling that this is outrageous. I just don't think we're close to that here.
Well, where I one area where I would agree with you, I do think that there is an element of Remain supporters, Hillary Clinton supporters, almost wanting to justify the Trump Brexit victories by the fact that they must have been cheating. I think that where there is a story around personal data, and I think there's an ongoing, that's going to be something that, you know, in the digital world is going to continue. It will be interesting to see if millennials, to use that term, continue not to care, or if as they get older and they suddenly become much more savvy about this and much more bothered. I guess time will tell. But I feel like the punchline to this story, which I think is the flimsiest, is that, right, Cambridge Analytica got this data, and we you know, the accusation is they got it through ill-gotten means. Obviously, that's contested. But then they then helped Trump get elected in a tight race using this data. And I think that last bit is a huge leap. And it just feels a little bit like the liberal, I don't want to use the word liberal elite, but the kind of, I've just used it, I suppose. People want to sort of believe that Remain cannot possibly have lost, well, Brexit cannot possibly have won, Trump cannot possibly have won legitimately. And then it's almost they're trying to build up this idea that it must have been cheating. I mean, I don't know what you think.
Yeah, so I entirely agree with that. That said, I would still want to separate. So what I think I've seen a bit of, and I don't agree, is taking the argument you've just made and then going a step further and basically saying, therefore, we shouldn't talk about this story. Because I think the story is important, despite saying I don't think that people are morally outraged by it. I think it does matter how our data is collected and used and who has access to it. And I think that is an important debate for us to have. And electoral laws matter. And if electoral laws have been broken, then that needs to be exposed. But I don't think that spells up to anything close to suggesting that the elections were therefore illegitimate. And I think we from our professional lives are well aware of many other attempts to target people based on personal data.
Yeah, because I mean I think we have to try, and we all have our biases, and I'm sure, you know, listeners or people that follow us on Twitter will be the first to call them out where they disagree with us. But you know, we've got to try and be consistent here, haven't we? And I know that the Obama campaign would argue that they use data in a totally different way. But there is something about the idea that they were geniuses who were great, and then the Trump campaign is evil and sinister, isn't there? I mean, doesn't that feed the point I was making, I guess, that there is this kind of trying to delegitimize those victories? Let's talk a bit about the actual Cambridge Analytica themselves and what they claim to do, because I think that maybe an underanalyzed part of this story is their quite outlandish boasts about how they could use data and just how effective that is. I mean, some listeners will know that, I mean, what you and I met through working for a polling company, PSB, I don't think that's necessarily secret information. And one of the things, that's an American polling firm. And I mean, when we worked there, and you know, they came to prominence during the 90s and through working with Microsoft and the Clinton campaigns. And that was all about what was called micro trends, micro targeting, trying to identify different really important niche audiences and really tailoring the message to those audiences. This isn't new, is it? This idea that, well, you've really got to find the niche audience and tailor the message to them is not like new information, is it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And
because Cambridge Analytica talk like they've got some sort of secret sauce, and I don't.
Yeah, but I think what is so quantitatively different that it's effectively qualitatively different is that social media data, in theory, allows this to be done so much more cheaply that it's not only the very biggest, best resource campaigns that are able to target people on the basis of individual interests and likes and stuff. So the basic principle of it is not new, and we've both been involved in sales pitches where we've somewhat overhyped the abilities and the impact of
the things
we're selling, Kieran. But it's hard not to watch the Cambridge Analytica video and slightly wince and think, I mean, not quite there, but for the grace of God, go I. But you know, you can see that how that happened. But
just to be clear, dear listener, we have never sent prostitutes to political opponents' houses. I'm not quite sure what was his name, Alexander Nix. I'm not quite sure how that fit into his algorithms, but I mean,
the point is you exaggerate stuff, but there is still, and I think it is important, despite the feeling of bemoaning that there is about this, it is important to understand what can now be done and to have proper rules about it, because this is not going away. It's only getting easier and cheaper. And at least having some transparency about it does feel important.
I think the financial aspect is important too, and tracing the money, and that's the bit I'm following quite closely is okay, Cambridge Analytica are involved, but who owns Cambridge Analytica, and then who funds them? And you know, there's a web there that I don't want to create a sense of conspiracy too much, but I think that's the type of thing that, as ever in politics, you kind of have to be quite careful with, you know, follow the money, as they say. But then at the same time, you know, I was reading before we came on air that I think the Tories spent, I think, four times as much on Facebook as Labour, at least, at the 2017 election. I think the Tories spent a couple of million, and I think Labour might have spent half a million, maybe not even that. And I think most people assume that Labour's Facebook game was much better.
Labour were good at it, so they didn't need to spend so much because they got earned views as the Tories.
And they had organic shares as well. And I think that this comes to a point that I would make to most people, is that it's all very well and good micro-targeting, that is obviously a value. If you can imagine, let's go back to Trump. If you can imagine the GOP base, there are presumably all sorts of different groups with different messages. You know, there was the enthusiastic Trump voter that thought certain things. There was the cautious GOP voter that didn't really like Trump, but, you know, you wanted to get them to vote Republican, anti-Clinton. So I can understand how you might want to send different messages to different people, depending on who they were. But I wouldn't lose sight of the fact that the micro message is fine, but you need the macro message as well. Make America great again. Take back control. Change. I would actually add, to a lesser extent, the many, not the few, which is very noticeably something that Labour have really pushed. It's always been there, but the last election, they definitely seem to hang stuff on that much more. So I think that you can do the micro messaging all you like. The Clintons themselves are, and particularly Hillary, you know, big proponents of that, but unless you've got the big eyes, big ticket, big picture, you're not going to get anywhere, are you? And I think that's the thing that maybe the people that oppose the type of Brexit we're having and the people that oppose Trump at the moment, they haven't got that macro message yet.
Yeah, well, what's the counterpoint to take back control? There isn't really one, and you know, I think that speaks volumes.
Let's talk at the moment, let's in closing talk a bit about the anti-Semitism row, if that's the right phrase to use, because we haven't talked about it on this podcast, and I suspect that people would like to get, you know, some views on that. Remarkable week, really, isn't it? This has been something that's been bubbling under the surface for a little while. It feels like, again, another example of the Labour leadership not really reacting quickly enough and effectively enough on it. I don't know what your perceptions were about that.
Yeah, I think obviously on this podcast, both of us try and be as, well, essentially leave our own personal opinions at the door. I think it would be unfair on listeners if I didn't say that what I've said elsewhere publicly, which is that the anti-Semitism row has really frustrated and upset me, and I personally feel like Corbyn hasn't done well enough. So having said that, sort of take whatever else I say through that prism. I mean, it feels to me like, frankly, I don't expect this to have that much of an effect directly on the polls. This feels, unlike the Russia stuff, closer to something that is like, I don't know, the IRA allegations. Just quite difficult, I think, for most people to fit into their frame that they already have about Corbyn, which is of a fairly kindly old man whose flaws are essentially that, if he has them, that he's just not really on top of things and just sort of has these old ideas, but isn't really able to do stuff. Now, it's really hard to see how anti-Semitism fits into that frame that most people have. So I struggle to see the idea that it's going to get people thinking, what, he's nasty or he's secretly a bit racist? It seems really unlikely. I think what could happen is the damage of the Labour Party once again being seen as being divided is more problematic. And particularly with an election coming up. I mean, you know, it's only a few weeks till people are going to the polls for the locals in England. So, you know, there will be a test on this, that even if it's only a temporary hit, it is potentially relevant.
I'm unconvinced it's going to have a huge impact on the local elections, just because I think turnout is going to be quite low. I suppose you could make the counter argument that for that exact reason, it might have a big impact. But the local elections are in pretty favourable areas to Labour. Can't see them losing seats over this. I mean, I think that they might maybe not do as brilliantly as they would have otherwise done. I guess we'll see. But I don't think they're not going to do very well in London. Maybe certain areas of London, there'll be interesting analysis to do on. I mean, let's, you know, on where there are high proportions of Jewish people, that might be a subplot to the end sort of story that comes out of those elections. But I think that's, and I'm sure George Osborne and the Evening Standard will, you know, look into that, as it were. But I can't see it having a huge impact on them. I think that where I do think it's going to have an impact is if there's this idea of Labour being divided again, sort of starts coming to the fore. I saw something on one of the blogs, I want to say Politics Home, this evening, suggesting that John Woodcock was going to resign the Labour whip. So if you've got a Labour MP resigning the Labour whip over this sort of thing, that feels like, okay, it's a Westminster bubble story, of course, but then is there going to be a by-election? Probably not, maybe. I mean, it just resurfaces a lot of the old issues that Labour have that seem to have gone quiet since the general election.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that's the story, really, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, obviously that cuts in multiple directions for what that does. You know, certainly you can see how that only entrenches the problem further in terms of division in the party, because no doubt Corbyn supporters will say we'd be ahead of the Tories if it wasn't for whatever name this coup will be given. You know, and that's not going to help things. But yeah, I don't think, I mean, the weird thing is Corbyn, who is immensely popular amongst Labour members, is fairly unpopular among the public. So Labour's quite good poll score seems to be, I suppose, has priced in the fact that people generally don't think Corbyn is that good, that he's slightly behind Theresa May often in polls, or somewhere around the same place. Theresa May, who obviously is widely accepted as not very good. So if this slightly damages Corbyn's reputation, well, it feels like the Labour vote isn't based on him personally anyway. So not really sure what damage that's likely to do. It feels much more about the perception of the party that's relevant.
I'm just seeing in traditional Polling Matters style, there's going to be a YouGov poll coming out at 10 o'clock tonight in the Times. So I can only assume that that's going to have some degree of story to it. But Leo, no, thanks for your time on this week's podcast. It's great to be back behind the microphone. Lots of subjects to pour over there in the coming weeks and months. In the coming weeks and months, we'll be trying to do more on the local elections, looking ahead to May, seeing what we should expect there, and trying to get into some of these other issues in more detail, such as Russia and Facebook, and of course all the other ensuing dramas that come out of Westminster. But for now, thank you all for listening to the show, and as ever, if you do like what you hear, please do share it far and wide as much as you can, or tell a friend about us. It really is the main way that we get our name out there, get the podcast name out there, and it's always great to have new listeners. So if you can see your way to sharing the podcast, that would be fantastic. Otherwise, goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.